the other party. So what I'm doing is I record actually a lot of my meetings at work because then I can go back and correct my notes. I'm also going to start trying to post audio of the class lectures along with the class notes because I know there's lots of stuff I cover that is not necessarily on the slides. I also know that once we get past the first exam and somebody does well, there are those who prefer to spend their time elsewhere on other harder classes and just study this material independently and come back for the exams or ask me about things individually. That's okay. Okay? If you look at the rubric or you look at the class syllabus, you see that class participation is not part of the grading system. And class participation is not necessarily where you are picking up technique. If you feel you can pick up technique successfully working on your own and not coming to class, more power to you. But I'm going to call you, you're going to have a come to Jesus moment when you come to the final exam and have to take the exam, right? Okay? So participation or attendance in class may go down a little bit, but remember, the exams are mandatory, the homework's mandatory, and so forth. Are there any questions about that right now? So I'm going to go over one common misperception. I'd say this was on about, I don't know, maybe as many as a third, which makes me worry that I accidentally somehow misled people or introduced a bad concept somewhere. So we have this is the porch problem. This is problem number 5 on the midterm. And it's a very common kind of projectile motion complication because I'm not throwing something from the same level to the same level anymore. I'm throwing something up. Oops. And I'm even drawing it incorrectly. So I drew a picture something like this, right? Where you're Romeo and there's Juliet and you want to throw her a lead rose so you don't have to worry about air friction. Boink. Sorry, Juliet. Okay. And there were a couple of distances in here that were this distance and this distance. There were a lot of people that drew that triangle with, 4.6 meters. What was it? 4.7 meters, 4.6 meters.
4.7 up, 4.6.
4.6 across. Okay, there were a lot of people that drew this and said, aha, that throwing angle is theta. Okay, that is wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong. If I were to do this, it would mean that I was throwing directly at the top of the railing. If I throw directly at the top of the railing and there's gravity, what's going to happen? My rose for Juliet is going to go plonk and then fall on, somebody else's head, right? It's going to curve down. Do not immediately take a position triangle and say that angle is the same as the angle of the corresponding velocity triangle that ends up in here with V sub X and V sub Y and the total velocity. Those are different triangles. And there were quite a few people. You are not alone if you did this. It is a somewhat easy misconception to make, but it is a deep and pernicious misconception, and ultimately at the bottom of this is laziness. You're trying to shortcut something. Right? You're looking at a triangle and saying, oh, that triangle is like that triangle. And not thinking, not engaging your brain about what really would happen if I threw this thing at that angle. Because if you just ask yourself that question, it's obvious those angles are not the same. Okay? And I intentionally designed the problem so that, yes, this looks like 45 degrees, but this throwing angle is way off of 45 degrees. In fact, the ratio of the velocities is closer to 2 to 1, and this angle is more like 60 degrees. So you have to throw the thing up from horizontally. Okay? So I just want to clarify that and make sure that people understand that misconception, and that if you run the movie in your head for the particular situation, and it just takes a second to run the movie in your head, kind of obvious I'm not throwing straight up at the top of the railing, and so this velocity is not at this angle given by that triangle. Okay? So, whoops. Are there any other questions about the exam? In the emails I sent out last night, I also gave you a link, because I'm trying not to post all of my solution guides straight to the web for the entire world to see and take advantage of, including other classes. But there is a solution guide with the written out, typed out solutions for all of these problems. I'm a geek. I use LaTeX, which means that it's all nicely formatted and hopefully easy to read. So take us a look at the solution guide. If you have any questions, some people already have and have approached me. If you have any questions, email me, see me after class, see me before class. We'll go there, okay? So any questions so far? Your classmates will benefit if you ask. You may even benefit if you ask or not. 3, 2, 1, yes. Which one?
Problem 1.
Problem 1 from the exam? Okay. There is problem 1 from the exam. So this is problem 1. The the easy misconception, or the a very common misconception or misperception in problem 1 was you looked at the second part and said, I don't know the acceleration. Well, it's a two-part problem. You look at the first part for the acceleration. So I've got a constant acceleration vector here. And I've just got kind of my x and y axes. So that's that direction, that's that direction. And this thing is a constant acceleration vector of a, where a is 4.9 meters per second squared, and this angle is 50 degrees. So in the first part of the problem is what are a sub x and a sub y? Okay, so you can draw the triangle. This is a. This is a sub x, a sub y. Degrees. So using Sokotoa, of course, a sub y is equal to 50 degrees times the, is equal to a times the sine of 50 degrees, and a sub x is equal to a times the cosine of 50 degrees. And to get the signs right, remember you always have to look at the way the arrows point and compare them to the axes. This is generally the way that I teach what I do, right? And this is not necessarily the way that you've been taught. Some people may be taught, in fact are taught, to look at this and use theta of 310 degrees and then not worry about the signs. That's fine too, One of the problems that I find is that this, being taught to do this all the time, gets extremely hard with advanced problems or with coordinate systems that are not at your typical coordinate systems. And it is very easy to make a mistake. On the other hand, if you always draw a triangle where you're always using an angle less than 90 degrees and you can visualize that triangle, that is the triangle, and then you fix the signs from the way that things point relative to the unit axes, that works universally. And you don't have to worry about quadrants and things like that. Okay, so that's generally why I teach that technique that way. But that also does mean that, and it is kind of obvious, if you just look at the picture and think about it, this a sub y points in the opposite direction of positive, so it must be negative. This a sub x points in the positive direction, so it must be positive. And then you can plug and chug your numbers, and you get some numbers out here, and you look happy, okay? So that's part A of this, plus a little pro tip about taking sines and cosines of the angle and getting the sines, SIGN, so the components right. And now what I say is this object starts here and accelerates with this constant acceleration A. I even say in the second part, this constant acceleration A, and I use the same A as the first part, so it should be the same number. There are multiple ways to do this second part. So the second part is looking at B, part B, how far was my displacement, delta S, in 2 seconds, when the initial velocity was zero, the thing started from rest. Now you can do this lots of different ways. You could say delta X is equal to V0XT plus 1/2 AXT squared, and delta Y is equal to V0YT plus 1/2 A sub YT squared. Because you figured out what A sub X and A sub Y were in the first part of the problem, these guys are both zero, because the thing starts out from rest. And then you can figure out, okay, that's a delta x, that's a delta y, and that's the total distance that it goes. That is perfectly fine. It's a slightly long way to do the problem. So, but that is one way to do the problem and one way to get the right answer. Another way you can do the problem is you can just say delta v, some distance was the original velocity times t, well that's still zero, plus 1/2 times the net acceleration, the total acceleration I gave you at the beginning, times t squared. And this delta b is, you know, that s or whatever, that distance I went in a straight line. Because it's a one-dimensional problem, man, you're moving in a straight line with a constant acceleration. The coordinate system doesn't have to be like this. I just ask you for the distance. I don't ask you for the coordinate. So plug those numbers in, that acceleration, that time. You get the distance, and that is a somewhat faster way of getting a smiley face on that one. I put no smiley faces on anybody's paper. So if you're worried that your paper doesn't have any smiley faces on it, I didn't put them on anybody's, I just put them up here for amusement value. Did that answer your question about question one?
Yes.
Okay, good. Whenever you ask for feedback, I'll always double check and make sure your message got through. My fiance is a communications prof. She kills me if I don't do stuff like that. Any other questions so far? Yeah.
Question 5B.
Question 5B?
Yeah.
Okay. So I am not going to work out the entire problem, but I will sketch out the solution and talk through it. So question 5B was the throwing an iron rose to my sweetheart problem. And this is 4.6 meters, this is 4.7 meters. And then this distance here is 2 meters. Okay. So part A, so I tell you in the problem essentially that the at the top is at the railing. And the velocity, the vertical component of the velocity up there is zero, right? The thing is only moving horizontally, the beanbag is only moving horizontally over the top of the railing. Part A asks for the time to the top. And you can use a standard kinematics equation to find that. You don't know the initial velocity, but you do know the final velocity. And you can then figure out from there, well, it's V final minus V init. Well, there's a... You can figure out the time to the top. That wasn't what was asked. So part B, however, is the initial component of the thrown beanbag, the initial velocities. Okay. And if I know the time it takes to get to the top, so for the vertical, well, I have a distance that I went, delta y. I know dy zero. T plus 1/2 AT squared, where now I should draw my axes, X and Y, and I should draw acceleration, and acceleration is minus 9.8, because it's pointing in the opposite direction, positive. So I know the distance it went, 4.7 meters, I know the time, and I know the acceleration, so I can get V0y. Just use the movie equation. And for the horizontal, well, for the horizontal I have delta x is equal to V0x plus a sub x t squared, whoops, 1/2. Zero xt plus 1/2. There is no acceleration horizontally. Right? Gravity is only acting vertically here. So the horizontal component of the velocity is just how far I went in the amount of time it takes me to get to the top. So that's how you get both of those components. And then you can figure out the angle, right? Then you can draw the triangle, but only then you can draw the triangle. This is V0y, this is V0x, and this is the angle of the throw. But do not draw the position triangle and try and figure out these components, assuming that you know anything about the velocities. You don't. Does that answer your question, kind of the approach? Yeah, Stephanie.
If you could assist, there are multiple ways to do the problem.
Yeah.
So if you do it this way, can you just show how you would have done the top?
How I would have done what?
How did you get part A? Like,
Oh, sure, absolutely. So for part A, almost everybody, including me, actually solved for the velocity first and then figured out the time. Okay. There are two ways to do part A. One is a little tricky in the sense that you have to figure out that velocity first and then the time. And to figure out the velocity first for part A, since you don't know the time, you've only got one equation to use for kinematics, right? And that's the v squared minus v zero squared, and this is v zero y squared is equal to 2/8 of y delta y. Okay, well, you know that the final velocity is zero, and you know how far it went, and you know gravity, so you can figure out that initial velocity, right? And then you can use that initial velocity to figure out the time using something like, v sub y minus v zero y is equal to at, or some people use the movie equation, right? Delta y is equal to v zero y t plus 1/2 at squared. I mean, you can solve either one of these for t because you know everything else vertically now once you solve for the velocity. That's one way to do it. The other way to do it, and it's the way that I would do it, but I didn't write it in the solution guide because it is a little tricky, and that is to flip the problem, right? Physicists are all about symmetry. And for me being about symmetry, well, I know that the velocity of the throw up, if I reverse the movie and the ball is falling down, I can run the movie like the ball is falling down from that height, and I can do a cheap, quick little thing, which is again finding the, you know, the question is what's the time it takes for a ball to drop 4.7 meters from rest under the influence of gravity? And that would be delta y is equal to v0 y t plus 1/2 a sub y t squared. Now this is from the top. And from the top, I know that initial velocity is zero, right? So if I know from the top that initial velocity is zero coming back down, then this t is equal to the square root of 2 delta y over a sub y. And I know how far it fell when I knew gravity, so I can figure out the time directly that way. But it's a little bit of a cheat, right? Because it's running the movie backwards. But the better way to do it is to do it the first way I said, which is figure out the initial velocity and then figure out the time. This quite understandably might feel like a cheat, right, or a trick. And I don't want you to feel like it takes a trick to solve a problem. But I just showed it to you two different ways, and both ways give you the same answer, and both ways are perfectly valid, and they'll give you the same result. Did that get you? Okay. So for those of you that are geeks, I mean, I know everybody writes in Python nowadays for their scripting language. I'm an old fart. I write quite naturally in a language called Perl, and the Perl language and the Perl documentation has an absolutely wonderful acronym. It's pronounced TIMTODY, and it really means there's more than one way to do it. Okay? And with a lot of these problems, there's going to be more than one way to do it. As long as your technique is good, as long as you get to the end in a logical way, you'll be fine. And I'm here to try and help point out the detours along the way where you might accidentally drive off the road, like assuming that the position triangle is the same as the velocity triangle. That's driving off the road.
I still use Perl at home too, dude.
There's if you learn a language and grew up with a language, it's going to be a native language to you. You can be expressive in it. Does not necessarily mean it's wrong. There's more than one way to do it. So are there any other questions about exam problems right now? I think I have to start moving forward a little bit just so we can get into, oh my God, friction, normal forces, and things like that.
Now forces.
More forces. And remember the shopping list of forces, because we're going to add in one other shopping list item on forces. And that is friction. Okay, and various people did point out before, and even raised the question, when I had boxes sliding along a surface. And we assumed so much was frictionless. If you are not told something about the friction in a problem, if you are not given enough information to calculate the friction things, assume it's frictionless, right? I will do my best in all of the homework that I give you to say this is frictionless, if it's frictionless, or here's the frictional coefficient of blah, 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 or maybe that's what you're calculating for me. But it is not, you should not have to read my mind, right? And it's not a game of gotcha. The other thing is, when you get out into the real world, yeah, you're engineers, sorry, you're going to have to deal with friction. And when you get, some of you may end up working in the wonderful and glorious world of nano engineering and nanotech. And in nanotech, this gets much, much, much messier, because it isn't just friction in a macroscopic sense anymore. You have van der Waals forces between atoms, and you have all kinds of electric potentials, and you have all kinds of stuff that doesn't scale the way that all of this big macroscopic box on the floor shit does, okay? So hooray for Brownian motion, among other things. So friction, few things to remember about friction, and this slide is kind of one-stop shopping for friction. Friction always acts against the direction of motion. It's kind of intuitive, but if you're writing a model and being a physicist or an engineer and writing down a model to describe things, friction always acts against your direction of motion. Friction never helps you push something. Right? It's what's known as a dissipative force. And okay. So I got a chair here, right? And I can take this chair, and I can push it across the floor, and yeah, sure, I can feel that chair pushing back at me. That chair, you know, there's some friction between that chair and the floor, and if I put on frictionless coasters, there'll still be some force, there'll still be some friction, it won't be quite as much. Okay? So far, so good. So, oh man! Oh, now there's a lot of friction, right? Okay. Clearly, the friction depends on something. It depends, yeah, on the amount of mass I'm pushing on, pushing around. And Lord knows, Jared has a bit of mass to push around. Just a little. Okay. But clearly, friction is not just a counteracting force against my push, but it depends on that normal force as well. And in fact, if you do some experiments, you might even do some experiments in the lab. I don't know, because I don't really follow the lab. But if you do some experiments in the lab, and you put Jared and somebody else smaller and somebody else bigger on the chair, and you push them around and try to measure that force of friction, you rapidly come to the conclusion that the force of friction are given to the surfaces is proportional to the force pushing between those surfaces, that normal force. So here now we have to do full 2D things, right? We have to draw the force diagram. We have to calculate the normal force, and the force of friction is proportional to that normal force, and that constant proportionality depends on the objects. It's called the coefficient of friction. The unitless kind of thing takes a force going into another force. Generally, from now on, I try and write the normal force as a little n, because if you write the normal force as a big N, like you might have done in high school, and you're writing all your forces in newtons, boy, it gets complicated. It gets confusing fast. Right? So choose your notation wisely. Try and avoid pitfalls of using the same thing for multiple things. Okay? So there's that force, that constant force, which is what's the force of kinetic friction, right? A force that resists you as you're moving. And it pushes against the velocity. And then there's a force of static force, just getting things going. And those two can be different. And they're different in subtle ways that do go down to van der Waals forces and the tannery, you know. It goes into the microscopic details of how the two surfaces are interacting. It may feel like drag is just friction from the atmosphere, right? It turns out that if any of you arrows out there, or any of you that have ever done computational fluid dynamics stuff, it's a lot more complicated. The way to model it is actually being proportional to the velocity. This friction here, the force of friction doesn't really care about the velocity as long as I'm moving between two different objects. So this is kind of a picture now, a story, right? I take an object, like somebody sitting on the chair, or just the chair, and I start pushing on it, and I start increasing my force, and it doesn't move because the force of static friction continually opposes me. At some point, boom, it lets go. I overcome that static frictional force. Now things become a kinetic force. It's kind of the force of friction opposing me has suddenly become less, and I'm starting to move the object. So, again, from experience, from observation, you're going to ask an 8-year-old, and they'll not know the words, but they'll be able to tell you that the static frictional force, the static coefficient of friction, is probably higher than the kinetic coefficient of friction. It takes less force to keep something moving than it does to get it started. And that's exactly what that plot shows, right? With the little static coefficient of friction being 0.5. This is something just made up. And then the kinetic coefficient of friction being 0.4. So as soon as you get going, you don't need as much force to keep it going. So, classical problem, and this is now you're getting more tools in your arsenal. And when we get to energy, in just a couple of lectures, maybe even later on in this lecture, when we get to energy, you'll even have a lot more tools in your arsenal to start looking at and modeling and calculating things out from various problems. You have kinetics, so you have the way that things move under constant acceleration, constant forces. Now what you have is you have the way that something might move along the floor with all these forces acting upon it, and now it's slowing down to a stop. Yes? Remember, the coefficient of the frictional force is constant until the thing stops, right? It's just the normal force times that coefficient of kinetic friction times the thing that relates to how the two surfaces slide together. So I can draw a force diagram. Standard technique. Draw the force diagram. Draw your axes, horizontal and vertical. Write out Newton's laws. And here, vertically, it's a static problem. The thing isn't bouncing off the table. isn't falling into the table. So vertically, the normal force is equal to the object's weight. And on a flat surface, that'll be fine. On a inclined surface, which we'll get to in a second, it's not. And then horizontally, there's a net force slowing this object down. I took a box, it's going to be tough to push my chair this way. I'm going to push the chair and let it go. And thank God it didn't go and bonk this in the back. So I'm taking an object, I'm starting it off with a constant velocity. I'm letting it go. All the forces on it are constant until it stops. How far does it go? How long does it take to stop? I can run the movie, which means I should be able to calculate it. I can do the experiment, which means I should be able to calculate it and compare it to what I measured doing the experiment. Horizontal forces are here, and this, in fact, the time to stop now depends on that coefficient of friction. And boy, I made a typo on this slide. I'll have to fix it. Hey, Todd, fix the typo on slide 4. I accidentally put a sub s in here. This should be the kinetic coefficient of friction, right? It should be the two things are sliding together as the box stops. So I need to use the kinetic coefficient of friction because the things are sliding together. But this is, in fact, a way. Now I can take my chair, and I can take a time. I know my initial velocity, how fast this thing is moving. And then I say, boy, okay, that thing slid to a stop in about a third of a second when I pushed it 1 meter a second. I can plug those numbers in, and I can measure the coefficient of friction. Right? That's how you measure these things. And then I can use that to calculate how the chair stops if I put Jared on it and push at the same velocity. How long will it take to go? How long will it take to stop if I put somebody on the chair and push it 1 meter a second and then let it go? Will it be shorter? Will it be longer? It'll be the same. The equation says so. The equation says, I don't care about the object's mass during this experiment. The time it takes to stop. And that's because that initial velocity, there's a lot more momentum going that direction. If there's a bigger mass, it's smaller momentum. If there's a smaller mass, right? So the masses all cancel out in that horizontal equation. So this is how you'd measure something like the kinetic coefficient of friction. How you measure the static coefficient of friction is you take the object and you just start measuring, with some spring or something that measures forces, how much you're pushing until the thing barely gives. And right there at that edge, we'll let you calculate using the same approach, except it's statics now, the static coefficient of friction. But you can see now how some of the tinker toys, how some of the Legos, how some of the tools in your toolbox might act synergistically together, right? Now it's like, oh man, crap, I got that. You can have a problem with forces acting on an object in multiple dimensions, including friction, and that object is moving and slowing down or speeding up, and I can figure out times and velocities from that, so I can put together kinematics. I can put together Newton's laws because it's F equals ma, and the A goes into all the kinematics, and I can fold in friction. So you're starting to see just how all of these pieces fit together, and how you can start doing more practical and more interesting and more difficult problems. So this is a classic problem. And yes, oh God, he just said, oh, this is a classic problem. because it is a rather classic problem and a problem that I like to do. It's not quite static. Okay? So, but I know that if I have something like an eraser on an inclined plane, and if I push it, it pushes back on me. I know there's a coefficient of kinetic friction between me and this eraser. I know that if I take this surface and I turn it 90 degrees, that eraser is going to move. Right? There's going to be no way, no normal force to create any friction between this object keeping it from falling down to the ground. Unless they're sticking together in, with Velcro or something like that, and then it's not really an easy physics problem anymore. So that means, okay, well, the eraser isn't moving here at 0 degrees. The eraser sure moves at 90 degrees. If I know something about the friction, I should be able to figure out the angle at which the eraser starts to move. And I can lift this side up, and I can measure the angle at which that eraser starts to move. And by my eye, it just barely starts to move around 47.43 degrees. Okay, not really. It's somewhere around 50 degrees. I can only gauge angles by eye to maybe one significant figure. But if I work out the math now of that situation, and this is Newton's laws, it's inclined plane, so it's different coordinate systems, and it's friction, and it's following the same damn recipe, draw the picture, draw your coordinate system, draw your little force diagram, and apply Newton's laws in vertical and horizontal, or horizontal and vertical. And yes, the unfortunate tricky part, but it's not that tricky once you do it a couple times in the homework, is you have to know how to break this one weird force that doesn't point in the X or Y directions, this force of gravity, you have to know how to break it down into components. Once you do all of that, once you write out these equations, it's almost all the rest is just plug and chug, or just manipulate, just algebra. So vertically, the object isn't moving, so the acceleration is zero. So the normal force is now not the mass, right? Not its weight anymore, but it's that weight times the cosine of theta. Right? If I turn this thing 90 degrees, the normal force is zero. If I have this thing at 0 degrees, the normal force is its full weight, of course. And then horizontally, I draw out these various things. There's gravity trying to pull it down, and there's the force of friction keeping it from going down. That's it. I can solve those two equations and write things out. I'll realize that actually all the masses cancel, which is pretty cool. And I'll realize that, oh my God, there's a remarkably simple relationship between that coefficient of friction and the angle at which the thing starts to slide. Thus, the coefficient of friction is the tangent of that angle. Okay? Now, there's a little subtlety in here. What's the tangent of 45 degrees? 1. Okay? Coefficient of friction is how much I multiply the normal force by to get the force of friction, right? It would be really, really weird if this chair pushed back at me with more than its weight. It would be really weird if that coefficient of static friction were larger than the object's weight. It can happen. That can be a really sticky surface. Huh?
were easier to pick it up and move it.
Right. So it is quite possible that the coefficient of friction can be greater than one. You don't tend to think of it that way because you tend to think of things sliding like this eraser, on the blackboard,
or pushing boxes across the floor. But there is no reason. And also, the remarkable thing is if I have my eraser, and it doesn't even slide when I've got this thing at 90 degrees, that means, the coefficient of friction is infinite. There's no normal force that's being multiplied to produce a frictional force that's non-zero. And that is also consistent with this calculation of the relationship between the slide angle and the coefficient of friction. Okay? So let's do this for 10 minutes. You can take a break too. So work on the tangible or ponderable and come back at 5 after, and we'll discuss this ponderable. And you've got an eraser. A lot of people like to use cell phones, but be careful, because if you got a plastic cell phone case and you're trying to slide it on your board or something like that, it's really going to want to stick to the board. Now I've got extra boards or extra test boards up here too if people want to play with these. Because you're supposed to be making little measurements. Here you go. The pen boxes are all often good. Good test of this. Hey, how's it going? Yeah, Joanne's got all of them in the back. So. So velocity is speed and angle,
uh-huh.
And the angle is always changing as it goes around. Right? So velocity is changing. So I ask, is the velocity constant? No, it's changing.
If it's not changed to the velocity, what is going on here?
Right, but I ask, is the velocity constant? Yeah.
I have a question about the in-time thing.
Sure.
So if that spot at rest, that is the frictional, frictional force is the something F.
Right, the mu, that's the mu.
Because the object vertical force is zero, right?
Both are zero, right? So it's both force. So if the object, so here's your inclined plane. I got an object, okay, and there are three forces acting on it. Right, this is M. This is the force of friction, which is mu sub s times m. Okay. And this is the force of gravity, which is mg. Okay. So I drew a coordinate system like this, because it's easier to do this way. If I drew the coordinate system like this, I'd have to figure out components of both of those guys, which is more work. I'm lazy. So here at this picture, is so this is mg, this angle is theta, so this is mg times the sine of theta.
How do you know if you want to find the component of that mg? How do you know which angle?
So that's a good question, right? So Robert back there also asked this question last. So I got.
Does that mean the angle is between the negative y?
Uh-huh. So what this angle is, it's really how much is this thing rotated from the vertical? Right, because in the vertical, if this were in the vertical, this would be pointing straight down, right? So, and that angle from the vertical is zero. which is the same as the inclined plane angle, right? Say that equals zero, right? So as I lift this up, you can see that this angle opens up the same way. So that angle, this angle theta, is also this angle.
So the angle between here.
So let me also help with one other thing.
Right.
And that's right, that's exactly right. That's the angle between negative y and the mg. Right? So this you're pointing in the minus y half direction. Right? You're drawing your axes here. Right? So and then my component is here and here. Okay. Many people, and it is very easy to make this mistake, many people don't go through all of that and they accidentally draw this way. That's a mistake. Because this is parallel to y, but this is not parallel to x. So this is not the x component anymore. The x component has to be here. Right? Okay. And the 90-degree angle has to be between your components. So as long as you always remember that, you'll always do it right. Okay. So I've got this situation, and now I can write down, f net y is equal to m a y 0, right? And f net x is equal to m a y. Is also equal to zero because this is a static. The box isn't moving much. Okay. So, and if the box isn't moving yet, let's call this one and call this two. Equation one here. In the vertical direction, I've got m is up, and I've got this is mg cosine theta minus mg cosine theta. Okay. And then in 2, I've got mg sine theta. And then what's pushing backwards is that force friction, which is equal to that thing. Okay. I can solve this for now. And then I can put this in here. You know, say mg sine theta. Is equal to mu sub f times mg cosine theta. Oh, look at that. The m and the z is all kind of odd. And I get mu sub f is equal to cosine theta.
And then also, if the object is moving, the f net y also zero, but not the difference.
Right, exactly. And if the object is moving, this is the coefficient of kinetic friction, right? Okay, this is K. Right? And if it's moving, the question is, is it accelerating? Because that makes sense. If it's moving at constant velocity, then this is still zero.
So we cannot, if the object is actually not constant
velocity, then you have. Right. And then you have to know one extra thing. You have to know how it's moving or how far it goes in a certain time. You have to be able to calculate the acceleration, or you have to know something about the friction to be able to really follow everything else.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oops.
I'm back out to play.
Thank you.
The underlying mechanism can be actually very complicated, right? So.
Thank you.
Okay.
So welcome back. Hi.
One of the, oh, look at that. There you go. There's the answer. So this may all seem, you know, straightforward so far, but be careful because, right, I mean, every step of the way through the semester, we keep on adding stuff. And one of the things that, well, I don't think you engineers, you know, probably need it nearly as much as people in 100 level physics who are pre-med students or liberal arts majors or something like that. One of the big challenges of something like physics is it is a collection of knowledge where everything can build on each other and everything can be related. So as we add in energy conservation, as we add in rotational motion, right, and all of a sudden it's not just this thing sliding down the ramp anymore, but it's this thing, you know, now instead of an eraser sliding on the ramp, it's going to be a ball rolling down the ramp later on in the semester. And that ball rolling down the ramp, yes, the friction is the thing that's pushing on the ball to make it rotate. If there were no friction between this ball and this surface, this ball would just slide without spinning. But because there's friction, the ball rotates and rolls as it goes. And as we start to add in all the math of the rotational motion along with the kinematics, along with the friction, along with the two-dimensional motion on an inclined plane, all of a sudden you start to realize, I hope, that you actually have the tools to do stuff that is pretty complicated. And yes, it's idealized at some level, but wow, you know, if I'm describing motion on an inclined plane of a sphere or a, you know, of a rolling pen or whatever, you know, a three-dimensional object that's really physical that you might actually have to do some engineering about later on in your lives. Okay, maybe not a handball on a whiteboard, but something like that. You're going to have the tools to do it, and that's one meta message I want you to carry along, is that by the end of the semester, the problems that you're able to do, if you learn all the techniques, are not easy problems anymore. And if they are easy problems, well, that's great. Get out of this class and into a harder class, because there's harder technique down the line. So I asked you to, you know, play around with things, you know, on your whiteboards or on the back of your laptop, whatever it is. Play around with the idea that coefficients of friction can be greater than one.
I can't have something pushing back at me, pushing against me, from friction with more than the object's weight.
And also, once we start getting into this, right, there are a couple of obvious extensions that we'll get into. So some coefficients of friction I put on some numbers. This is from physics.info. You can get it from Wikipedia too, of course, right? These are simple examples of coefficients of friction, of numbers. So sometimes as an engineer, it certainly helps have an order of magnitude idea. What is the rough number? And some of these are rather remarkable, right? In the sense that, okay, ice on ice, there's very, very little difference between the static and kinetic coefficients of friction for the most part, particularly if there's a little layer of water between them. The reason that ice skates work so well on ice is that you're applying enough normal force on that ice to actually create a thin little layer of water on top of the ice between your ice skate and the water and the surface of the skating ice. And where you slide around is actually on that microscopic little layer of water. And it's due to special properties of water and its compressibility and its frozen form that it's like that. But there are other things. I mean, cast iron, you know, you're designing some device where you actually have to have iron pieces rubbing against each other. You're going to have to worry about heating. You're going to have to worry about friction. You're going to have to worry about all sorts of crud. But it is also rather staggering that the coefficient of friction changes by an order of magnitude when the slip occurs. So if you're an engineer building something and you expect these two pieces of iron not to rub against each other, but something fails and they start rubbing against each other, they're going to keep on rubbing against each other. They're going to give. Okay? All of a sudden, when that surface-to-surface join lets go, and it's no longer static, but it's kinetic, it goes fast. That's not something obvious, and it's something useful to know. Okay, so as engineers, you may think, you know, okay,
oh, coefficient of friction is Todd pushing around something on the chair. It's also when your bearing goes, or when your slip goes within your mechanical device and fails, it fails catastrophically. I've got a good family friend who designs turbine engines for GE, for major, you know, for fighters and for other planes and stuff like that. Boy, they know when, you know, a metal-to-metal surface goes. So, They just weren't measured. They were just weren't on the website. You can run and measure them if you like, but, you know, the coefficient of static friction between concrete and rubber. Some of these are really kind of hard to measure because they can be very large and be very dependent on the details of the objects, right? There's, you know, dry versus wet. This is all, you know, you really care about the rubber on concrete and rubber on asphalt kinetically as a driver, because these things are, you know, when you're skidding, you care about the skid. When you're rolling around, it's all dominated by the roll. But when you're in the skid, man, that dry versus wet skid, whew, there's a difference. So before I get into this next part, I want to point out one thing that you might see in the homework. I'm going to assign more homework later on today, due next Wednesday. So I always try and give you at least a week to work on the homework. But the other easy way to complicate friction, and it is an easy way to complicate friction. Okay, so I'm applying some force, and then here's a normal force, here are my coordinates. Okay, just like the inclined plane, here's my force diagram, and the force of friction.
And let's say that this object is not moving. So this is the coefficient of static friction times the normal force. Okay? And you might say, oh, yawn, Todd, N equals mg. And then this is mu sub s times mg, blah, blah, blah. Okay? It is very, very easy. Jared alluded to this earlier. What happens if I change the angle of that force? If I take my chair and I'm pushing my chair around, okay, if I'm pushing down on the chair, I'm increasing the normal force, right? I'm acting, some of my force is creating extra pressure downwards, extra force downwards. And the normal force has to go up to keep the chair from going into the floor. So I'm creating extra friction as an extra normal force by pushing down. Ultimately, if I push up and forward, there's less friction, right? I'm reducing the normal force. So now you can do the same math, but you have to decompose that force into components. There's your theta, and there's F sub X and F sub Y. And sure enough, when you write down the vertical, you know, F net comma Y is equal to M A sub Y is equal to zero because the thing isn't moving up or down. Well, now you need to include this component here. And so it ends up being N minus the Y component of that force minus MG is equal to zero. So the normal force is bigger because I'm pushing down. And then you work through the rest of the math. But it is very easy to take, you know, friction problems and now complicate them by adding in extra forces that change the normal force dynamics. Do not blithely make the assumption, unless it is completely obvious, that N equals mg, or N equals mg cosine theta, like an inclined plane. If you draw the pictures, yes, okay. In those particularly special cases, you can get there. But remember, always remember, that the normal force came from the Newton's second law about the vertical motion. And if there are other forces acting vertically, you need to put those forces in. Okay? Good enough? And it's, again, naively, intuitively, somewhat obvious. If I push down on the box when I'm pushing it, boy, harder to push. If I push up on the box while I'm pushing it, if I lift it a little bit, okay, I'm exerting more force pushing upward, trying to lift the thing against gravity, but at least I don't have to fight friction. Oh, I'm tired from pushing these chairs around. Okay? When I push the chair around over a little bit of time, there's a special quantity that physicists talk about, which is a force applied over a length of time. Force applied over a little length of time or a force applied over a lot of time. If you are a rocket scientist, and literally rocket scientists talk about this thing in terms of impulse, the thrust applied over a certain amount of time when you fire your rocket engines, or my buddy with the airplane engines doing a similar thing, you end up getting a quantity called impulse. So there are lots of different things that we've defined so far. Velocity, lots of vectors, velocity, force, momentum, etc. Another one that's useful, and it's in the same direction as the force, is something called the impulse, which is just adding up force over time. Okay? An impulse is units of force times time, and those units of newtons times seconds. I don't think there's a special unit for it, not that I know off the top of my head. But boy, if I push this chair, man, I'm getting tired of pushing this box or this chair around all over the room, all over time.
Okay. If I do it faster, oh, maybe I can cut down that time. Oh no, man, if I do it faster, I'm still getting more now. There's another quantity that's even more important than impulse. And it's not, right, it's not the force times the time I applied it. That's the force over how far I applied it. And that's work. So when you do your homework, apply a force over a distance. Take your book and lift it. Do some bicep curls. The force over distance. And that integral is just adding it up over lots and lots of little time intervals, or lots and lots of little distance intervals. But the work done is the amount of force applied over a certain distance.
So impulse is somewhat useful, but work is extremely useful. Work, force times distance, Newton meters. One Newton meter even has a special unit. It's called a joule. And we'll get to it in a little bit, because this is your first example of energy. And just like we started writing down a little inventory of different forces that you know about, force of gravity, force of friction, okay, forces that you're given in a problem. Now there's all sorts of different places, categories, places where you can account for energy. And later on, energy will be conserved, and I'll teach you all how to be accountants, because all it is two-column accounting. So, but work is force times distance. One of the things, okay, I mean, technically, force is a vector. I apply a force that way or that way. I draw the pictures, right? And technically, distance, displacement, x, is really a vector, right? I can have a displacement up, displacement left, right, wherever. So ultimately, that slide should, if you really, really do it properly, you define work as the sum of force dotted with a distance. And that dot is called the dot product. And what it does is it takes a vector dotted with another vector, and it gives you something that's a scalar. One of the really useful things about energy is it's a number. 5 joules. Not 5 joules that way. Not 5 joules that way. 5 joules. That's all it is. I calculate out my work, my force times this distance.
Is it the same as the force times that distance? Yeah. If the force and the distance are the same, the directions didn't matter as long as I,
as long as that sum ended up being the same. That dot product is very, very useful. When we get later to rotational motion, you're going to get cross products between vector components all over the place too, and it's going to get a lot harder than it did in high school. So, but work, this is your first example. Of energy. And when we add in kinetic energy and gravitational potential energy and all the other forms, you're going to have a little shopping list that you can choose from when you do accounting of energy and energy conservation problems. Okay? How many people here have done integrals in Calc 2 already? I bet everybody has, I hope, right? So starting to use integrals should not be intimidating. But just in case, for those of you that haven't covered them already or need a little refresher because it's been 10 years since you took Calc 2, I got a slide on what exactly an integral is. Because I'm a math geek and because I was a math major when I was an undergrad. So So work is force times a distance. Work is me pushing the chair around. Me is me lifting the chair up from the floor against gravity. I'm applying a force, and that force is applied over a distance, that height. From conservation of energy, doing something like that, lifting the chair up off the floor, is going to let me calculate what the energy is from gravitational potential. Right? I'm stretching a rubber band between the earth and this chair by lifting this up. And then I can let that rubber band snap to get that energy back. Okay? So where are some examples of work? Work is a bookkeeping tool. We're going to relate it to energy. We are rapidly getting into the bookkeeping part of the course. The next kind of couple lectures are going to be all about just bookkeeping and learning separate formulas for allocating energy in different bookkeeping examples. Conservation of momentum is the same thing except with vectors, so it's a little bit harder. One of the nice things about energy, like I said before, is it's a scalar. Okay? So it only counts a dot product. If you remember your handy formula, a dot product, A dot B, is A, B, cosine theta. Okay? In other words, if the angle between the two vectors is zero, it's a maximum. The angle between the two vectors is 90 degrees, it's zero. The dot product is zero. So if an object is moving, but I'm applying a force to it in the perpendicular direction that I'm moving it, let's say, you know, Jared, somebody is sitting on this chair and I'm pushing this chair. Jared's exerting a force on this chair too. Is he doing any work? No, because his force is perpendicular to the direction of motion. You lean down and, you know, help push with his feet. Okay, yeah, I'd be doing some work because he'd be exerting a force in the same direction. But really that dot product is the magnitude of the two vectors times the cosine of the angle between them. So some examples, you know, pushing the VW bug exactly in the same direction it's moving, maximum work. Pulling along your little suitcase, okay, only the horizontal component of your pull is really doing the work. The other part is just lifting your suitcase up from the floor, the vertical component. And when the waiter is holding onto that tray, his arm holding the tray up is doing no work. It's just balancing the force of gravity. His legs are doing some work, though, because his legs are moving his body and the tray and everything forward over a distance. So work is defined as this thing when that force and that distance are parallel. And for a constant force, I can take this out. The integral of the distance is just how far I went. So if I take this chair and I lift it up against the force of gravity, well, let's figure out what is the work. This was the first example of gravity. And now I'm lifting the chair up. And I'm going to lift it up. Let's say this is a delta y. Okay? And what I'm doing is, now this doesn't matter about the time. It doesn't. What I'm going to do is, I might just as well exert a force that just barely counteracts the force of gravity and keeps this thing moving at constant velocity. Okay? If I'm counteracting the force of gravity like that, that means that my exerted force here is exactly counteracting the weight of that object. And so the force is equal to mg, and the work that I do is the force times the distance, mg delta y. In high school, you may remember something like, you know, work is equal to gravitational energy, mgh, gravitational potential energy. And that's what this is. The gravitational potential energy of lifting something up against gravity. Roller coaster. Put it on a hill, lift it up against gravity, let it go. Now all of that energy is transformed into kinetic energy later on. And we'll get into kinetic energy in just a little bit. This is a simple example. A harder example is this one. I got a spring. What was the force of a spring? The force of a spring, that's something that clearly doesn't work with that pen anymore. The force of a spring was equal to minus kF. Okay? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to move this thing over this distance, delta F. And the work is the integral of that force and that distance. Okay. Now this is the force from the spring. On the box. So when I calculate this integral, I'm going to integrate this force, minus kx, dx, and I'm going to get a minus kx squared over 2. Right? The integral of that thing is minus kx squared over 2. This is the work that the spring does, because I am using the force of the spring on the box. What? The spring did negative work? Is that right? Can you do negative work? Yeah, you can. It's called storing energy. And my force, if I was exerting, you know, if I was pulling this thing, well, I have to counteract this force to move that box. So my force was a plus kx, and the work I did ends up being what plus 1/2 kx squared. So what I did, and oh boy, man, I pulled this box against that spring. Oh, I exerted this force lifting this chair. Where did all of that energy go of my work? It went into gravitational potential energy. Right? It went into the spring between the earth and the chair. But now you're starting to see already another couple of accounting terms. If I got something lifted up against gravity, here's how I can account for that energy when I add it up. If I pull a spring, here's how I can account for that energy. If I'm talking about the spring, I need to make sure that I use the right time. So I'm storing energy in the spring when I stretch it. So when we come back next time, we're going to talk all about how we can start adding these things together to do real problems. And oh my God, then connect it back to kinematics. Oh my God, connect it back to friction. Because you can actually, you know, the force from friction. The force from friction is constant. Energy, the work from friction is real easy. Constant force, so it's just the force times the distance, right? So now all of a sudden I've got 3 or 4 or 5 different Legos that I can apply to problems to figure out things from energy conservation, which will be the subject of the next lecture. So we're done for the day. I will put homeworks in, and it will include some homeworks on energy conservation, of course, along with work and homework.